bank-regulated activities.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everybody. As Hans said, this is an education session for rate-regulated activities. As I'm sure you remember, in December last year, the ISB tentatively decided to develop an interim standard to allow grandfathering or continuation of existing accounting policies for rate-regulated activities, subject to some restrictions. And the timetable agreed at that meeting is very tight, so we would like to try and begin the balloting process as soon as possible after this meeting. So consequently, we scheduled two sessions for this meeting to discuss our proposals for the detailed content of that interim standard. This first session is an education session to provide you with an opportunity to seek clarification on any of the proposals that are contained in papers 5 through 5F. Thursday's session is where we'll ask you to make decisions on those proposals. So we're not asking for decisions this afternoon, just giving you an opportunity to clarify those proposals. All of the proposals are summarised in the cover note, which is paper 5 for the agenda. And we're trying to reflect the constraints that were imposed or agreed on at the December meeting. And those constraints are summarised in paragraphs 3 and 4 of paper 5. So it's looking at trying to permit grandfathering, but only for those entities that currently recognise regulatory items in accordance with GAAP accepted in their local jurisdiction, requiring that those regulatory items or balances are separately identified within the financial statements, and recognising some sort of impairment review or impairment test for those assets. Within that context, trying to provide this interim guidance as quickly as possible and making sure that it doesn't delay too much the main project on rate-regulated activities, where we're looking to develop a discussion paper later in the year. So within those constraints, I think it's possibly worth highlighting here that to try and make our work more efficient, we have tried to utilise the work that was done in the previous project. So many of our proposals try and build on those proposals in the 2009 exposure draft, or if the reaction to those proposals was negative, we've tried to use the comments that came back from the previous exposure draft to revise and refresh some of those proposals. Also, I think it's worth highlighting here that a terminology point. Throughout all of the papers, I've tried to refer to these regulatory items as regulatory deferral account balances rather than regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, because one of the main aims of the main project is to try and identify whether these things are regulatory, are assets and liabilities in accordance with the framework, and if they are, how do we actually measure them, how do we classify them, what types of assets and liabilities. So just as a terminology point, I thought it was worth clarifying the reason for that switch. I don't propose to go through each of the proposals, so I was just going to open up the floor to allow you to ask whatever questions you would like to raise.
Can I ask a question on the scope issue? The reason I'm bringing this up, Jane, is not so much for this proposed concession that we are giving to certain jurisdictions. I looked at the proposals that we raised in 2009 exposure draft, especially the second criteria, which many felt that it was as such broad enough that it would give away, would bring in a lot of unintended entities into the rate-regulated activities. And one of the comments I remember quite well is that some insurance companies also will be under this proposals, right? Now, you are suggesting in this paper, especially in para 11, to expand the scope so that different jurisdictions who are already using this rate regulated can be accommodated without restricting to the cost recovery aspect of it. But my only worry I have is that, are you by any chance doing this kind of expansion without really deliberating? Because whilst I completely appreciate the desire to get an exposure draft at the earliest, we are on a steroid-based issuance of an exposure draft here. And my worry is that the scope is so broad that tomorrow, I know how you're going to ring fence it for this particular thing, but tomorrow this might handicap this board in discussing about the scope and how to limit it if we have to do it. I don't know how to do it, but I'm just worried. You have two competing objectives. One is to accommodate those people who are asking for it. Second is that since we are basing this on a 2009 ED, I'm worried that without complete deliberation, we are expanding the scope. So that's a competing requirement. So I don't know how to deal with it, but I'm just cautioning ourselves that we need to be very careful. We are not bound by it when it comes to full standard.
If I can perhaps address how I'm hoping that we're dealing with it. In terms of the scope, you're right. The 2009 ED was focused very much on the type of regulation, which was cost of service, where there is a direct link between the costs allowed by the regulator and the rate that is then based usually on a cost-plus methodology. And the majority of the responses to the ED in 2009 commented on the scope, and the majority of that majority said it's too narrow because pure cost of service regulation is really going out of fashion, and more regulators, for very good regulatory reasons, are trying to relax a little bit the link between the costs, and they're usually anticipated costs to build into the future rate. And the way that the cost of service methodology was described, even though those new types of methodologies will pull back on a rebase to actual costs incurred, and a lot of people didn't think the 2009 ED would work, and there would be so few entities captured by that scope that it really wasn't worth doing the standard at all. And I think we're still in that scenario here for the interim standard. I appreciate your point about if we widen the scope, we're capturing types of industries almost that we're really not intending to capture. For the short term in this project, I do think we can achieve a ring fencing because we're looking to do is only allow people that are currently recognising regulatory items to continue to do so for the short term until we can deal with the main project. So for things like insurance companies, that in the 2009 ED, we did have some comments from insurers to say we're worried we're going to get caught in the scope for certain types of contracts. Because they're not currently recognising, we're not going to pull them into the scope of this. And really, it's the main project where we do need to really focus.
My suggestion would be, why depend on 2009 ED for the scope if our intention is to allow those who are using the quote-unquote rate-regulated to do it? Let's not build on 2009 to do it, because it might give a false starting point for in the future. Your intention is to do it, just let them do it, and that's the scope.
There were one or two a few respondents to the exposure draft in 2009 that thought the scope was way too wide.
Yeah.
As always, you get two opposing views on these things. And the reason they thought the scope may have been too wide was a worry that people would effectively self-regulate, or there would be companies in a monopoly type of situation that would look at the economics of rate regulation and say, well, you know, we have a lot of very similar characteristics to these rate-regulated entities, so we should be able to apply this by analogy. And that's one of the reasons for proposing a scope for this, rather than just leaving it very open-ended and to say anybody that's doing this can carry on doing it. We do want to try and put some limitations to make sure it's the type of entities that we're really trying to capture.
Ian? Yes, Mark. Questions almost related. I'm not too sure using the 2009 ED for this interim standard is always suitable. And if you take some of your disclosures down in 7A is not so bad, because it's only if you've got a balance. But some of your other disclosures are for whether you're rate regulated or not, even if you don't recognise an asset or a liability. And so you're going to pick up all sorts of companies that presently don't have a note, like 7, no, wait a minute, 8A and 8E. And why would we require them to do that all of a sudden? Wouldn't we worry about that when we get to the final standard? All we're trying to do with the interim is grandfather what's going on now.
So as I said last time, someone have disease, ask others, the whole world take medicine.
Yeah, well, that's probably great, but it does worry me a bit that, and then this will bring in who's going to be caught. You know, if there's somebody who's not recognising an asset and a liability, have to scratch their heads and worry if they're in the scope or not, because if they are, they have to make these extra disclosures. And I don't think in the interim they're going to help much. In the final standard, it might be quite legitimate.
I mean, the reason for recommending some disclosures for these entities within the scope is that the people that are recognising these things, and I appreciate, Wego, your point about we don't want to spread the disease across, but if we're looking at this in the whole, we're being told by a lot of people that information about the regulatory environment is important to understand the future cash flows, the profitability position of these
entities.
But
I'd go back to my point that we'd cover that in the final standard. But here, for instance, AD, a statement that the regulator does not permit a return on investment for a regulatory deferred account balance. Now, if you're not recognising a balance of any sort, what good sticking, it's a boilerplate note.
We're not, sorry, that particular disclosure, we're only asking that for people that are recognising them. So for entities that are not recognising balances, we're looking at some fairly high-level qualitative disclosures rather than the detailed quantitative disclosures.
Why would we do that in an interim standard? I know people are saying it's good information, but as I say, I think we should cover it in the final standard and leave those that are not recognising any balances at the moment alone. That would be those that are recognising balances, sure, we want some disclosures on how they're made up. But those that are sitting there doing nothing at the moment, why would we suddenly?
To be fair, a lot of the financial statements, and I know that I'm, you know, can only possibly look at a small sample compared to the hundreds in the population, but the majority of ones, or certainly all of the ones that I've seen, do have at least a brief note, usually in the management commentary, just to highlight that they are subject to restrictions because of the regulatory environment. It's not a huge amount of detail, but I don't think that this recommendation would add a great burden to these types of entities.
Well, I don't know if you are reinforcing or destroying my argument, because if they're doing it satisfactorily at the moment, why are we bothering? At this stage, as I say, this is an interim standard. It's quick. It's trying to cover those people that are recognising assets or balances at the moment. And so why would we sweep up everybody else in an interim standard? That's really my
Okay. Philippe?
Well, I have a similar remark as Jan. I think for those who do not recognise, I would leave them quiet. Do not bother them with doing more than they're doing, which is okay today under IFRS. Now, I have a question about the scope, to make sure I understand exactly. Seems to me, I don't see in the paper a condition on top of the regime that you describe. I don't see a condition that the current standards, GAAP, local GAAP, require recognition of those balances. So assume a local GAAP is silent, and the company does recognize some balances. Purely on an election of an accounting policy, absent any standard. Is it still okay to continue? Or is there a requirement for the standard to be there to require? And is there a risk that if the local GAAP is silent, a company might say, well, seems to be a permission to start recognizing balances that I did not have before. So I want to make sure we do not permit to move from non-recognition to some form of recognition at the time of this interim standard. And I want to make sure that whatever is already recognized is on the basis of requirement by local GAAP.
I think this is dealt with more in paper 5B, which deals with the recognition and measurement, rather than 5A, which focuses on the types of entities.
5A is silent on those scope issues.
Yeah.
It's also related to the December decision we made that limited the scope of the whole short-term project to grandfathering existing practice for entities that currently recognize regulatory deferral accounts in their financial statements in accordance with their jurisdictional gap. So it seems to me, based on the decision in December, to even get to your scope paragraphs, you first have to comply with that.
It's fine with me, Patricia, provided the gap require. If the gap gives options, which could be the case, maybe not in Canada, but maybe in certain jurisdictions, I don't know, if you have a system where you could opt or not opt, is it the same that we want to do in that case?
But I think, Philippe, we are saying that they would have to have been recognizing these in their policies, so they would have already recognized these balances prior to applying the standard. So whether that was because of explicit or implicit allowance under local GAAP.
Okay, that's fine. So there is no possibility to start on that basis doing something.
You don't want somebody changing their policy in 2 months or four.
And the recommendations that we've put forward is to utilise IS 8 and the hierarchy so that they stay with paragraph 12 of IS 8 on accounting policy choices, which allows them this implicit, if it's not explicit, if it's accepted within industry practice, within their jurisdiction, but then we're just taking them or recommending we take them out of paragraph 11 of IS 8, which we see as the blocker because that's the link to the conceptual framework, it's the link to other IFRSs. But tied in with that, there's also a recommendation to use some wording that's currently in IFRS 4 and some similar wording in IFRS 6, which will make it clear that starting to recognise these things wouldn't be permitted.
Just clarification. On the, you mentioned that main objective is, in terms of scope, companies that are currently recognising regulatory assets and liabilities. So just, I guess I would like to clarify, so if a company is already applying IFRS in a particular jurisdiction, but for this portion of the balance sheet, they use current GAAP, are they going to be allowed to apply? Because this is not IFRS 1 anymore.
No, I think in that situation, that their locally accepted or their jurisdictionally accepted GAAP is IFRS plus rather than pure IFRS. And again, I think that would be captured within, you know, they've got that as a currently accepted accounting policy, so they would be allowed to continue that under this standard.
Christian?
Are we just talking about this 5A, or are we talking about all the papers?
All the papers.
Okay. So I have a question that deals with the interrelationship between the scope that we were just talking about, the deemed cost exception in IFRS 1, and our overall objective, which is to relieve the burden on those entities that are maybe going to IFRS that have regulatory assets that might have to be derecognized, but then maybe re-recognized when we finish the big project. And so our proposal is essentially, if I understand it correctly, to have a balance sheet that is full IFRS and then add at the bottom of that the net regulatory asset or liability. I know you don't want me to call them that, but for shorthand, let me do that. And then a comprehensive income statement that'll be full IFRS P&L and then the effects of the changes in those regulatory items. So it seems to me that in order to apply this interim standard, an entity that is currently following some sort of rate-regulated accounting where those costs are embedded in their PP&E and in their intangible assets are going to have to go through the same exercise that they would have gone through if we didn't permit them to keep the regulatory items on their balance sheet. And in fact, it seems to me that it might be more work because under IFRS 1, they have the deemed cost exception on first-time application. So they can just take whatever is in their PPE account and say, that's my IFRS PP&E. But now they're going to have to break that apart between what would have been capitalized and what wouldn't have been capitalized.
No. What we're proposing, and it's this interaction, for these people, the IFRS 1 exemption would still be available. So we're recommending that is not withdrawn, that remains. So all of their current PP&E that includes these regulatory amounts, again, they would be able to take that as their deemed cost for IFRS purposes and IS 16 accounting at their date of transition.
Okay.
And so they only need to track the changes from the date of transition going forwards, which we understand that these companies do anyway,
yeah,
for regulatory purposes. So it's not adding any extra work to them. They've already got that information. And the reason the IFRS 1 exemption for deemed cost is there is that often once these costs that have to be kept isolated for regulatory purposes are formally approved by the regulator, they can in many circumstances be then moved out of the regulatory accounts into the PP&E accounts, which is why they can't go back historically and strip these back out in the past. So what we're proposing is they retain the same IFRS 1 exemption and they just do the separation on a forward basis, which is what they're doing anyway for regulatory purposes.
Yeah, the IFRS 1 exemption effectively deems these costs to be IFRS costs, mm-hmm. So it's now an IAS 16 cost as of the data transition.
There you go.
No, I'm firm against, but to be constructive, I still have some question. First one, on the scope, I fully support what PK and some others just said. It's not necessary for us to say anything about the scope. It's because we give those who apply the current, you know, such kind of gap, a leeway. That's all. And there's no reasons why we want finger out scope, which may create some kind of confusion. And this is my first point. I support PK. And secondly, relate to what, you know, Patricia just asked, I'm confused, you know. Based on what you just described, those Canadian company already went through IFRS 1, and no, let's assume, based on what he just said, and use their previous number of PPE based on their previous gap as deemed cost. All right?
Yep.
I don't think so. You know, if that is the case, why they still have the problem? So the reason why they carve out is because they one goes through IFRS 1 for others, but not for this type of asset liability. If they already, you know, went through everything, include this one, and recognize those assets based on our standards, which we accept those numbers as deemed cost, why do you still cry?
Well, it's because there's only, as far as we can find, there's only a handful of companies in Canada that have actually transitioned to IFRS. So we've only seen a very tiny number because there is this carve-out for rate-regulated entities within Canada that they've had a deferral of their timetable for transitioning to IFRS. So there's a very small number that have done it. They've used the deemed cost exemption. But everything that they're doing now is IFRS, and generally I found one exception to that generally, but it's a very specific fact pattern. these entities have written off their regulatory balances, and their PP&E is now at the deemed cost under the exemption they've got, and they're moving forward. The companies that we're talking about...
No, follow what you said. Those companies already went through the process, look on those assets, liability based on their previous amount as a deemed cost. And those companies already gone.
Yes, they're not going to get captured.
So, let me... So, there's no necessity for us to bring back the deemed cost notion at all, because all these interim standards are designed for those who have not went through the process. Am I right?
Correct.
If those already went through the process, they will use our current the IFRS 1 deemed cost, and no relevance to this requirement at all. Why we want to touch that?
No, it would be relevant for those that are going to adopt in the future. And so that if they're going to adopt IFRS in the future, but before we finish the bigger project. So if we didn't allow them to use the deemed cost exception, then they would have to somehow come up with what their IAS 16 PP&E would have been had they never used regulatory accounting, which is even more burdensome than going to IFRS today and then adopting regulatory accounting tomorrow. So we would be making it even more burdensome for them.
No, because I think there are only two tracks. Those companies either already went through process, it's nothing to do with these standards.
That's right.
Those who intend to go through number IFRS 1 will use deemed cost notion,
yeah.
It's nothing to do with these standards.
Yeah, because the exemption exists already in the IFRS 1,
yeah.
And do state very clearly
in
the paper 5E.
This is why I'm confused by this one and confused by what you say, and we may discuss later. I fully understand what you say and relate what Patrice just said before this meeting. I called Jen. I feel doubt the proposal for presentation is one line for balance sheet, one line for income statement. I feel doubt, firstly, the operationalities. How those companies can do. In terms of balance sheets, the numbers based on the previous gap already went into PPE, inventory, and others. We will ask them to pull out, firstly, is it operational to do so? And these numbers, the PPE and the inventories are moving. They are not stock, never change again. They are moving. How can you do it? And even worse for the income statement, based on the regulatory framework, the impact will be on revenue, general expenses, and others. How can you pull out those numbers? And secondly, we pull out those numbers. And what's the meaning? What's the meaning if you combine the other income statement numbers with a one-line number? From the user's point of view, and from the regulatory point of view, and even from the preparer's point of view. So I feel the usefulness and the operationality of our proposal. And Jen said that she already discussed with some of the Canadian standard setters or the maybe preparers. I'm not sure by the end we propose something, still no one happy. I'm not sure, I will vote against, but I put the question to you. And on the disclosure, I fully agree with Ian. And firstly, as I said, it looks like someone get disease, that who would take the medicine. And secondly, agree with you, your observation. Currently, those kind of entities under regulatory regimes, even though they use our standards, they will still have some kind of disclosure about the industrial features and the related regulations. I can imagine the disclosure is already there. And why we want to add something? If we do want to add something, and in the future, follow what you just suggest, we will add disclosure requirement for transportation industries and anything, and different kind of regulatory or industrial regulation regimes. So just a few, it is redundant to suggest to propose like this. I have some other doubts, but
well, you're being pretty extensive. So.
Could I have a question just to clarify so I understand this? As I've understood it, assume now that I go into IFRS 1st of January, then I redo my balance on the past and is there. What we talk about now is that the new things I do after 1st of January will be separately presented in the balance sheet and separately presented on the profit and loss statement. So I don't have to carry the old things. It's just the new things. We are doing an exemption for these guys into the future. It's not to facilitate their history.
Right. No. The historical items... Well,
that was the question. Was that correct or not?
Yeah, I mean, the in terms of the PP&E and some intangibles where these regulatory items have been included historically, they're going to be included in that deemed cost.
Yeah.
At the beginning.
So that is not an administrative problem.
That's not an administrative problem.
In addition to that, if they've got a separate regulatory asset or separate regulatory liability on their balance sheet, those would continue to be carried forward as
okay.
Well.
Good. That's what I'm
as a follow-up, so you have something in your deemed cost and the amortization, depreciation would be based on that. You don't have to identify how much it impacts your charge.
Yeah. Doctor,
yes. Thank you. Just let me discuss offset about disclosure. You are going to allow offsetting of assets and liability and using the analogy of IS 12. But I don't think we can use the analogy of IS 12. The environment is quite different. So if you read IS 12, paragraph, perhaps you are quoting IS 12, paragraph 71 to 74, but if you read the paragraph 72, say an entity will normally have a legally enforceable right to set off the current tax asset against the current tax liability when they relate to income tax levied by the same taxation authority, and that's taxation authority permits the entity to make or receive a single net payment. So that means in the case of IS 12, so what they are saying is if the, you have one single tax authority and you have liability and payable and receivable, and then you can offset because it can be a single payment.
Netted by the authority.
Yes, exactly. However, in the case of rate-regulated activity, normally the rate the industry will receive is from the customer.
Yeah.
And then, so the customer would be different. First, you have rate-regulated liability. Second, you have rate-regulated asset. However, only the such kind of deemed asset and liability is you only calculated artificially. And what is going to happen is you pay you receive less in the first year and you receive more in the second year, but customer could be quite different. How do you think how you can rationalize that such a liability and receivable to be offset on the balance sheet? So I can't understand. I don't think that using the analogy of IS 12 is correct.
logic thinking behind this is that when the regulator is setting the rate that's charged to the customers, they will take into account these different types of costs, and some of these costs may be showing a regulatory credit balance, others will be showing a regulatory debit balance on these deferral and variance accounts. But our logic was, if these are all taken into account in the same rate assessment in setting the rate, then they ought to be recoverable in the same period or reversible in the same period, because they're all connected to the same sales, to say items being sold.
But customer and the demand itself could be different. But if you are, say, oil-related heating industry, and then if the price of oil get higher, and then another natural gas or something could be much more reasonable, then customer may go away from your area. So in that case,
I think the point Jack's trying to make is they may often be netted, but they won't always be. So if you've got a long-term balance, like a pension, one, you may not collect it for another 15 or 20 years, and it might sit there and grow over that period of time.
Yeah.
So comparing that with a liability that's going to be paid for next year, you may have trouble offsetting it.
And also maybe, and you may have different portfolios of customers with different rate regulation impacts. You may have an entity which has several different locations and is subject to different regimes of pricing. So certainly they will have to show up differently or separately the assets and liabilities for those different regimes. Otherwise, I think you cannot match the invoices or revenues to anything on the balance sheet.
Right.
So can I touch upon that? One other thing about disclosure. This is about 5D. You would allow to aggregate some of similar activities. That is about the agenda paper 5D, page 1, C. So the more detailed disclosure may be aggregated for similar activities that are subject to similar regulation imposed by different regulators, instead of being presented for each individual regulators. I agree. In a sense, I agree that you gave some experience that could be appreciated. However, suppose if you are the, say, for example, Canadian industry, and that this has a strong competitiveness, and then they do the same business in Europe, and then they have a similar regulation in Europe. Say, even in that case, do you allow aggregation? So my concern is, for example, if there is a domestic similar industry in Europe, and they are not allowed to use this accounting standard. And if that Canadian company who is competitive came to Europe and do the same thing and use our new accounting standard and do not disclose how much asset and liability they recognized in their balance sheet is not really relevant. I think in such a case, they have to disclose how much rate-regulated asset they recognized in their balance sheet in, say, France or in Germany or in other countries. Otherwise, it will impair the comparability, and it will overly give advantage to those country who is going to use this new accounting standard.
So you're suggesting that we should have a geographical
Not exactly the geographical, plant. But it should be disclosed regulator by regulator, basically. At least geographical, or at least jurisdiction basis. Otherwise, you know, it is quite unfair. Because if we have same environment, if every single constituent of IFRS has the equal footing environment, then that's okay. That's practical expedient.
Why is it unfair? Why you want to justify fairness?
I think fairness means, say, for example, European company cannot use this interim standard.
They cannot use it anymore.
And on the other hand, say, for example, Canadian company can use this standard. So that then, of course, asset and the liability is different. And asset and the liability would be shown, disclosed in the balance sheet with that different line item. That's fine. However, question is, you know, on the note, it is aggregated. The amount they recognize in their balance sheet could be a Canada-oriented one or could be France-oriented one. And if you allow them aggregation, there would be no clue to know how much was originated in Canada, how much was originated in France.
The intent, though, is to break, I mean, there's a one-liner on the face of the income statement, but the intent would be to provide all the detail as to what's in those one lines in the notes.
Yep. So
it's not that there's no clue. And I think the concern I've got with where you go, to my mind, whether that asset arises in, whether that balance arises in Canada or arises in Europe or arises anywhere else, it is still a regulatory asset.
Yeah,
and
yes.
Still wouldn't appear on somebody in, for example,
exactly.
Yeah. So I don't think, as long as the distinction is available in the notes, I think that would be sufficient. I don't think you need to have it on the face. What you need on the face is to know that this is a different
face.
But then I think that's available, isn't it?
Well, we're not recommending that you do it on a regulate. You're right in that we just want a one-liner on the primary statements and then additional disclosures in the notes to the financial statements. And what we're looking for is a breakdown by different types of regulation, because we think that's important, because there are some that are more cost of service, some more incentive-based. They have different risks associated with them in terms of recoverability. So we think it's important to give some information based on the different type of regulation, but not necessarily on a regulator by regulator basis, because even within Canada, you may have one company that's subject to a large number of regulators because they're different areas of the transmission of electricity, for example. It depends on where you are in the supply chain as to which regulator. If you cross from one province to another, then you're subject to a different regulator. And so a lot of the feedback we got in the 2009 ED as well is regulator by regulator is just too burdensome and impracticable. In terms of your different geographical mixes, I would envisage this being captured by the segment disclosures. So if you have got different segments, so a Canadian segment, a European segment, or whatever, that ought to be brought out more. I think it's more appropriately placed in the segment information.
Patricia.
Related to the question I asked earlier about breaking up the PP&E and the intangible assets, I'm not sure I fully understand how the impairment tests are going to be applied to the regulatory balances and the perhaps related PP&E and intangibles in the IFRS statement.
I think in terms of the PP&E and the intangibles and the other items, I think if we can get this isolation and strip out the regulatory amounts, which are the amounts that otherwise wouldn't be captured within IFRS financial statements, I think once we can strip that out, if we look at the PP&E, even if it's come across at a deemed cost, that's now considered an IS 16. So for everything apart from the regulatory balance, we're in normal IFRS impairment. Okay. And I think that is appropriate and that would work well for the PP&E, et cetera. It leaves us with this rump, if you like, which is the regulatory balances. And in Agenda Paper 5B, we don't make any recommendations in terms of the measurement of that item. In the old 2009 exposure draft, has already been mentioned, it talks about trying to, or it proposed recognising it at an expected present value approach, which even for the people that accepted most of the recommendations or proposals were against that proposal, it's not workable, it's not practical. The majority of people recognising these things at the moment, it tends to be an accumulated cost type of approach because it is more of a bookkeeping type of deferral balance building up. Because we didn't recommend any particular measurement requirements, we're asking people to continue their current measurement. We haven't put any proposals in for measuring the impairment. In paper 5B, we have recommended that they need to make an assessment about recoverability of the balance. And I appreciate perhaps I haven't quite clarified enough in paper 5B that on an individual deferral account balance, so for each type of cost that's identified, you ought to only be recognising that if it's included within these allowable costs that the regulator would allow you to put into the rate reviews in the future, which is why it's a deferral balance. And there may be situations where the regulator, once it does the formal review of these costs, decide it's not going to be permissible, it's not allowable. And I think in that case, we can build some wording in to make it clear that those costs ought to be impaired, they're eliminated, because it's clear the regulator doesn't intend that they're recoverable through future rates. So I think we can perhaps be more specific than is indicated in the paper in terms of the individual balances. For the total balance then of costs that have been accepted by the regulator, are these allowable costs? I appreciate a couple of people have mentioned that the concern that you've just raised in that how do we do an impairment test. This balance doesn't generate cash flows on its own, so I don't think we can do an IS 36 impairment test on the balance. We may be able to put the balance into the cash generating unit, the CGU, to which it belongs. And we could then ask for an IS 36 impairment test on the entire CGU, which then raises questions as to if you then do measure an impairment loss, we need to address questions about allocations and whether it's reversible in the future. I'm not sure in practice how often you would identify an impairment loss on the CGU on the basis that we talk about these utility companies. The rate regulation is designed usually to make sure that these companies not only just recover their costs, but are actually viable economic entities. So I appreciate we may need to think about doing some more detail on impairment, but I'm not sure how much detail we need to go into on the basis it's going to be such a rare, I would imagine it would be a rare event.
Mary, this is
open
a
to view.
Maiden question.
And I can't believe it's on rate regulation. But it's on two pieces. One is the impairment and one is back to the scope. So I'll do impairment first because we were just discussing it. On impairment, I think, Jan, it's important what you just said, that we look to go beyond just saying assess for recoverability and pick up some of that thinking that you were just walking through in terms of the individual items, if they're disallowed by the regulator, shouldn't just kind of continue to sit there in a pool. And then the second one is thinking through some of the issues that have been raised about, will the demand support the higher prices that you're allowed to charge, et cetera, that you still have to have some kind of business level, so presumably CGU type assessment of the pieces that are in that single line for regulatory items. So I think it's worth building out beyond what's in the paper here that just says assess for recoverability without going absolutely crazy, but figuring out both individually and then as part of the CGUs how you approach it. So support that idea. Going back to the scope issue that we've touched on several times, it sounds like there's a combination of either two, well, a combination of a couple factors. One is that you're a first-time adopter of I4S, because if you're not a first-time adopter, then you're not in this interim standard. And I understand why we say it can't be part of I4S 1, because you need to have accounting that goes beyond your, date of adoption. So agree it's a separate standard, but I think it's probably worth bringing out this idea that you're a first-time adopter of I4S and, under your previous GAAP, recognized regulatory assets and liabilities. I'm not sure I'm with Wei Guo in terms of saying that's all you need to say and you don't have to describe the regulation, because I think that we might have unintended consequences, and one of the things that comes to mind is showing more of my history, which may be skeletons, is IFRIC 12. And if you're an entity that, if you're trying to decide whether you're in this interim standard or whether you're a service concession operator that's in IFRIC 12, I think you may need some pointers. So I think we probably do need some kind of description of the type of rate regulation that we're trying to limit this to. And we may have to think a bit more around IFRIC 12 and how you decide whether you're in IFRIC 12 or whether you're in the standard. And I'm just flagging that up to think about in terms of describing it. But I would say the kind of approach that you're talking about in paper 5A, paragraph 11 and 12, about trying to give some kind of description of the type of rate regulation, because we know what problem we're trying to fix, and let's try and describe that without being too pedantic about the scope. So that's the feedback I'd give on those two points.
Stephen?
Just to pick up on something Mary said, can you be in IFRIC 12 and this interim standard at the same time?
I think one of the things that the thing that I think IFRIC 12 distinguishes to me is when you're using infrastructure that you don't control. And so we're talking about assets that belong to the state and that you are contracted to use, build and use. And yes, because obviously IFRIC 12 itself does talk about the state does set the price or determine what price you can charge, and that's what rate regulation is as well. So I think one of the key distinguishing features is the infrastructure that you use is not within your control. That is why you go down the financial asset route or the intangible asset route in IFRIC 12. Yeah. Here, I think we're talking about predominantly issues where it's your own assets that you're using, because they do qualify for PP&E or they qualify for your own intangible assets. So there is a distinction there. Whether there's an overlap, though, there might be.
I wasn't going to ask about that, but I was going to ask about the single line item and deferred tax. Mm. So I think the single line item is great, that isolates the effect, but my understanding is that the two items in the balance sheet, the income statement, are both pre-tax. So there will then be a deferred tax balance associated with that in the balance sheet, which is merely going to be disclosed in the notes, and a deferred tax item in the income statement, which I can't find a disclosure for. So I think in order to truly be able to isolate the effect of rate regulation, you need those deferred tax amounts at least disclosed. Why not have the balance sheet number net of tax? The mere fact of isolating it is going against our presentation principles anyway. We're creating an exception. Why not put the deferred tax in there as well? Which makes it even more transparent as to what the impact of rate regulation is. And in the income statement, why not have the deferred tax charge or credit as a separate line item on the face, in addition to having the gross of tax figure immediately above the tax line, have the taxation split into two numbers, one of them being the deferred tax impact of rate regulation.
Steph will think about it.
Yeah, we got a little bit in 5E about the disclosure, but thinking of it, in the disclosure note and the reconciliation rather than as on the face.
Legal?
One question. One further comments is about measurement. You know, staff try to simplify the issue, but I don't think so simplified. This is one reason why Steve and I dissent from the beginning. You know, in reality, you know, the relationship between asset liability and expense revenue are not so straightforward. And because of, you know, different submissions by a particular entity, and I remember one paper and the staff give us examples, one company submits within a period 30, 40 submissions, you know, for approval to adjust the rate. And secondly, because of different regulators, you know, you will face. And thirdly, the time lag. And lastly, you know, the incentive schemes now, you know, different countries are now applying. So there's no direct link you can find. This is why the ED proposed expected notion. And even though not operational, but the reason why, you know, the staff proposed expected notion is because there's no link you can find. You have to, you know, use expected cash flow. And this is my comment. Not straightforward. This is one reason why this ends. And secondly, on the deemed costs, when you respond to Patricia and myself, it seems clear. But when you respond to the Young, the issue becomes, you know, unclear again. So after Patricia asked, I said there are only two tracks. One track is you went through four IFRS 1 and you use deemed cost. And it's nothing to do with regulatory, you know, this standard at all. All right? And secondly, if you not went through the process, and in future you also not intend to went through, and you will use this exemption, all right? This interim standards.
But to get into this interim standard, you have to come into IFRS.
You're coming into the IFRS, just like Canadian company do. You know, they will went through all the other standards, but only this one, they will not. Related to regulatory asset liability, they will not. But this is why the problem come out.
But
if they went through...
Isn't it the same with insurance or expiration? I mean, the aim of the interim standard is just to put in place what's there and hold it until we finish the final standard. So sure, there might be all sorts of problems with what's there now, but the aim isn't to solve all those problems in this interim standard.
No. What I want to clarify is, you know, my understanding is different from what you say, and your answers to me and to Young are different. You know, we must be clear. Those companies who already went through full IFRS 1, they already use deemed cost notion. They have no problem at all. Am I right?
Yes.
Yep.
And those have not gone through, and they will not use deemed cost notion.
Yes, they will.
They will.
No, I don't think so.
They will.
That's the difference.
They will, because a fixed asset is already capitalized with that number. Yeah. They'll carry forward that number.
Otherwise, they can't use this.
Yeah, otherwise it's too complicated.
Listen, Rego.
Please check.
Okay, just one short comment. Is there any way to save these entities, they are under IFRS, but they cannot use this interim standard, right? I'm expecting that many comment letters are coming to us, you know, claiming, you know, complaining about why we are good IFRS adopting companies, but we are not allowed to start recognizing regulatory assets, like you know, maybe Amaro is in the beginning raised the same question. So you are suggesting to improve to introduce allowable concepts, allowable costs, based on all comments raised at their first exposure draft. That is a big improvement. But, you know, apparently we are expecting many comment letters. It's unfair to say scoping out those entities, good, you know, best IFRS entities are not allowed, but I might say some, they are not following IFRS entities, they are allowing to use this recognizing regulatory assets. So what is there a good way to solve this problem? Because I'm already accepting, receiving many, many complaints already. You know, why not? Why not? We are not.
How did you vote last month?
Huh?
How did you vote last month?
you can have an option for anyone to use it. That is a solution.
Mm-hmm. Dean Cost question, can you ask the staff to call the Canadian to confirm?
They'll look into it.
We've been trying to coordinate, and looking back, there are occasions in the past where some Canadians, some preparers have actually sent unsolicited letters asking for an interim solution historically, and acknowledging within that you know, if the price to pay for that continuation is an isolation of the impact on separate items, they think it's practical and is achievable.
Yeah. Question very simple. Based on my understanding, they have not used the cost. And based on what you respond and based, as a board member said, they already use deemed cost.
Those that have transitioned have used deemed cost, but it's only a tiny number that have transitioned. Everybody else is waiting.
Be careful. The transition notion is two versions. One version is some utility companies already went through the process, except those regulated related items.
No, they've gone.
Let me finish. It's one type of. This is why, you know, the real situation is so complicated. Some companies, they already went through process, except those regulatory items.
What's the source of your information?
Let me finish.
This is your third go. So now, okay.
There are some other companies, utility companies, that didn't went through process at all.
Right.
The two versions.
Could you tell us which companies are supposed to be full IFRS today and still have those assets on the balance sheet today?
No, he's not saying they're full IFRS. He's saying that for everything else except their regulatory accounts, they went to IFRS.
When they fully adopt IFRS, then they'll be able to use IFRS 1.
Right. But we ought to write a standard, so we just put it into the standard and it's done.
Yeah.
I have to comply with it. Or they're out.
So this is as a staff. You asked me to check.
Yes.
No, I asked the staff to check.
No. Okay. Wait a minute. Those ones which are not full IFRS would benefit as well from the interim standard at the time they move.
Yes, if they're doing an IFRS plus, then that's not full IFRS. So they're into IFRS 1 and would benefit from grandfathering continuation as well.
So perhaps I should refer to them as IFRS minus.
Modified IFRS.
I guess this comes back to my initial question on this IFRS 1. Because IFRS 1 says that it's considered IFRS when there is a clear disclosure that we are in full IFRS. So my understanding, maybe try to understand a little bit Weigu. I guess his question is there any company that, according to Canada, adopted all the requirements in IFRS 1 for all sorts of components of assets and liabilities, but didn't adopt for rate regulatory assets? So are those companies that are then not considered full IFRS? Then in 2 or 3 years terms, when they had the project complete, they will be IFRS 1.
So they will have to redo what they've done in back in 1 or 2 or 3 years back for the other assets and liabilities, potentially, because they were not considered IFRS. There's another aspect. I guess this is what I'm trying to understand. So we are talking about the cost or the operational cost for one type of activity or asset, but they might have done IFRS 1 requirements for all other assets and liabilities. They will have to redo that in the future because they are not full IFRS, and this should be clear for them.
That's right.
One tiny question. Is there anything about the separate statements we need to consider? A legal entity might have different gap than IFRS. Can they carry that on and still be IFRS compliant?
May I comment again on your, because someone mentioned, I think, question about Brazilian companies. You mentioned complaints. I received some comments from Brazilian companies. We even framed an expression should be retrospective grandfathering. So, of course, this is, doesn't exist. But one comment that they made is that, well, because they adopted their view of some, because they adopt IFRS before this decision was being considered by the board, we didn't decide yet. But we had the exposure draft back in 2010. They've been penalized. So they adopt IFRS. They don't have rate regulatory assets or liabilities. And then the regulator obliged them to keep what the rate regulatory assets and liabilities. So they have two sets of information now. One is IFRS, one for the regulatory entity. So this would be a natural, reasonable alternative for not having an interim at this stage. But I guess we've passed this. We have a decision to issue the interim.
But my question is different. Yeah. Because in a country, it could be that the local gap allows, and they apply that, and then keeping that in the mother company or subsidiary or somewhere. Is there anything we need to consider about that?
I've thought about that, and I couldn't think of any issues there, because IFRS, if we're looking at the separate financial statements or individual financial statements, IFRS applies. So if they're not on IFRS now, they transition in. If we're talking about a parent company preparing group accounts,
then they can keep the regulatory assets.
On an individual company basis, then yes. If we're in consolidated financial statements, we're looking at it from the point of view of the consolidation. So if they've got a subsidiary already that's doing regulatory items under local GAAP, they're not, when they consolidate, it's a consolidation adjustment to strip it out.
Separate statement, they can do it. Yeah.
Okay, we take a break until 3:50.
And we continue with Lisa.
Thanks.
No.